We now go to Jennifer Belkis with Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire for Making Waves.
Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire. Seacoast Outright, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender support group, celebrates Youth Pride in Boston this June. One participant asks, what is New Hampshire doing for its queer youth? Listen to the story in two parts. I'm Jennifer Belkis. Thank you for joining me.
We hope to foster feelings of wellness, self-worth, and dignity among all youth, particularly among GLBTQ youth.
Tawny Walling, Executive Director of Seacoast Outright.
Hey, you're not a dyke. She says,
I think change happens because people want change, demand change. You have to work actively to make it happen.
Former State Senator Elaine Crasker.
I better, you know, jump on the bandwagon. So, I've never been to Pride or any sort of big gay event, and it's really long overdue because I love gay people. They're my peeps. So Tawny's like, oh yeah, we're going to take the bus there. Are you coming along? It's like, oh yeah.
I want to go just to be around gay people, support everyone. I think that there's not a lot of diversity in our area, and some people need to go places so they can feel more supported and find the people that are like them. There's activities all afternoon. I know that at noon we're marching through Boston. There's the Youth Pride Parade. And then tonight, there's a dance sponsored by Bagley, which is the Boston gay support group. And that goes from 7 to 11. It'll be fun.
Youth Pride Celebration. Yeah, Youth Pride should be really loud. It's cold. Thanks for bringing your small dogs also, people. If you haven't registered your small dogs with me, please come and do that. Okay, I'm the personal small dog registry.
Angela. The one, the only, the Governor's Commission on Gay and Lesbian Youth Committee. Come up here, kid. Come on. Whoa!
Foster carrier.
Thank you.
Psycho.
How's everyone doing today? Can you feel the energy in the air? It's amazing and tremendous and uplifting. So let's put it to good use. We have a wonderful opportunity here today, standing, marching, and celebrating right in the heart of our city's political arena. If we shout loud enough throughout the day, someone will hear us.
What I really did enjoy was Leslie Feinberg's speech. I guess I'm a huge Leslie Feinberg fan.
I'm here today to tell you at 56 years old, that in 1974, I was here in Boston for 6 months, helping to work night and day to build the March Against Racism. And I'm also here today to say, when people tell you who are older that they sold out because they're older, tell them, no, you sold out because you sold out!
He's not caught up on just the trans issue. Z is a true activist against racism, homophobia, transphobia, just any type of just any type of discrimination. It's out there for the entire equality for all.
One, two, three, four, open up the closet door. 5, 6, 7, 8, don't assume your kids are straight.
Okay, I'm going to say I like Barbie, you're going to say I like Ken, and I'm going to say I like women, and you're going to say I like men, okay? All right, okay, ready? All the females, you're saying I like Barbie, the males are saying I like Ken, the women are saying I like women, and then the men are saying I like men. Whatever you want to be!
We need some more men. There's too many women.
Alright, okay, ready?
Yeah, I can say both.
Okay.
Okay, ready? I like Barbie!
I like Ken! one man here.
I'll show with you.
It was really cool seeing everybody come together and like knowing that there's all that support and stuff like locally for, you know, gay and bisexual and transgender and all that stuff. And a lot of organizations that are like welcoming people with open arms and stuff. It was really cool.
No, it was just pretty nice. Pretty good. Pretty nice. They played good music and there was a lot of people there. It was a good time.
Particularly with youth, you know, they might not know until they're 30, put together all of the various parts that Youth Pride brought to them. So for them, it is absolutely the case where they'll be like, oh my God, there were so many kids and it was so fun and the Butchies were really great. And, you know, that's the level that they're going to talk about it at. But I believe really strongly that that having affirmation in a variety of different ways does permeate. And even though we cannot necessarily talk about that, particularly when we're young, that does make a difference both then and, you know, as we go along.
You're listening to the segment Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire. We'll take a break with She's So Lovely by the Butchies and be right back. Welcome back to the second half of Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire. In the first part of our show, Seacoast Outright and gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender youth celebrated June 9th's Youth Pride in Boston. The state entity, Youth Committee of the Massachusetts Governor's Commission on Gay and Lesbian Youth, directed the event. With this in mind, we now examine New Hampshire's role in its queer youth, the legislation, schools, and possible future. I'm Jennifer Belkus. First to comment is State Senator Martha Fuller Clark, Democrat, Portsmouth.
Well, I don't believe that we have any legislation on the books that would protect youth from discrimination within their school setting, and that might be something that we would want to have a commission such as exists in Massachusetts to look at how we could create a more welcoming community and environment for adolescents who are gay across the state. I have been asked to serve on a commission that was established about a year ago to deal with the issue of same-sex marriage and other potential issues surrounding the creation of civil unions in New Hampshire. The decisions that it makes and the legislation that comes forward will have an impact on the youth of this state as well as for adults. I think it's also, we should talk a little bit about the other organizations that we have. PFLAG, which has really been an important voice for gays and lesbian adolescents in the state, and the role that it has played in providing parents an opportunity to meet with other parents. And many, many times members of PFLAG do come forward and testify on issues that would impact on the youth as well as other gay and lesbian individuals. We had a very hard fight several years ago to make it legal for gays and lesbians to adopt in New Hampshire. I believe it was in 1997 that we were successful in passing the anti-discrimination legislation, which added sexual orientation to all of our civil rights language in the state, so that now gays and lesbians, again, whether they're youth or they're older, are protected in terms of their jobs, in terms of where they live, in terms of public accommodations. That's been a huge step forward. But clearly there are still issues of discrimination and of proper support. I know here on the Seacoast that several years ago I served on an initiative that was sponsored by the Greater Piscataqua Charitable Foundation to look at the issue of not just gays and lesbians, but of transgender individuals as well, and making sure that Portsmouth was a welcoming community. So I'm very, very proud to be a resident of the city of Portsmouth and look back on that work that we did to educate, if you wish, the straight component of our society to have greater sensitivity to all those issues of gender and the continuum of gender that youth is facing as they deal with their sexuality.
Dr. Paul Cody of the University of New Hampshire Counseling Center.
New Hampshire has taken some positive steps in the last several years, maybe the last 10 years, in terms of our non-discrimination and harassment law now includes sexual orientation as a category, so a protected category. So that's been a positive step. It's a pretty basic one, but it's a positive step. The state law does not include gender identity or expression, so that leaves open whether transgender and transsexual people are really going to be covered or could bring a case under gender, as opposed to the more specific terms that transgender and transsexual people have found legal protection for in other some other locales. Most of what's happening in the state that I'm aware of, and that's a big qualifier, is happening more in terms of nonprofits and other organizations, not state-led. I think that there are some people working within the government who have GLBTQ youth in mind and want to be of help, perhaps, but that I'm not aware of any really organized approaches to this. I think that it can be really important that people take the action to make our schools all safe. You know, a major issue is that of safety in schools. There's a publication, what's it called, Hatred in the Hallways, and it was put out by Human Rights Watch. So this is an international organization that studies human rights abuses around the globe. And they published something called Hatred in the Hallways about homophobia and harassment in American schools. And I think that that is an example where officials might not as easily tolerate harassment or slurs, hopefully wouldn't tolerate as much based on race or ethnicity, based upon gender. Whereas, you know, you go into schools and faggot or other anti-gay terms can be some of the most common things being thrown around. So I think that in terms of the basic providing safety in schools, that's really important, and that I would hope that our state could take further steps to do this.
Former State Senator Elaine Krasker.
There is a project called Respect for All, which is a program of the Women's Educational Media. Several years ago, they developed videos that could be used in the schools, particularly in the high schools, but could also be used in discussions with younger children, where issues like sexual orientation and students' reactions to those issues could take place. And I believe that I was told by a friend that this video had been used in one Seacoast school. I wish it could be used in all high schools, because I think it is so very, very valuable for discussions like this to take place, where people can let loose with their own feelings about sexual orientation, their reactions to it, and where young gay men and women can talk about what it means to them to be recognized and to be accepted.
Data are indicating to us that youth are coming out at younger ages than they did 10 or 20 years ago. And I think that this is due to several factors. One is the increased information, because there's a form of isolation that happens cognitively when people don't have enough information to make sense of their own experience. I know people who have known they were GLBT before puberty, at very young ages, or just at the start of puberty. And nowadays, with the growth of resources, internet resources, good internet resources, things like PFLAG or Outright, other resources such as gay-straight alliances in high schools or middle schools, Outright groups, which are freestanding nonprofits for GLBTQ youth, there's more opportunity for these adolescents to interact with their peers and be able to be out or as out as they feel safe as being, and get acceptance and support. So there's variety in terms of how people's families are taking the information of their son as GLBTQ or daughters GLBTQ these days, so that some families are being wonderfully supportive, other families are the sort of extreme we still hear about where someone's rejected or kicked out of home, and there are probably a lot of families in between where maybe it's a struggle for a while before the family comes to accept their daughter or son as the person that they're disclosing now. Although, of course, they've always been the same person. It's more just that they're talking about being gay or lesbian, bisexual, or transgender. There's a psychologist by the name of Rich Savin Williams, who's published a lot. He's nationally known on GLBTQ youth. And he's made an interesting point that sometimes the gay media particularly have highlighted the oppression, which is very real. And so there are youth right now who have been kicked out of their homes, disowned, things like that. But he gets concerned that it's to a degree that the fact that the majority of our youth are doing well and are succeeding or have families which might be struggling with it or completely accepting them from the start gets overlooked. So I think it's really important for us to keep that perspective in any story like this, that do we have evidence that GLBTQ youth are at higher risk of suicide than heterosexual peers? Yes. That does not mean most GLBTQ youth are suicidal. Do we have evidence that they might be at higher risk of substance abuse? Yes, that does not mean most GLBTQ youth are abusing substances. So sometimes people get data statistics really mixed up and think, oh, they're at higher risk, so that means most of them, which isn't the case at all. We need to have programs that address things like harassment. We need to have programs that provide adequate support for GLBTQ youth to reduce the incidence of suicidal behavior or substance abuse. On the far right, the people who say that gays are going to hell and all that sort of thing, some of them say that these statistics are, they actually twist the statistics to say that, you see, these youth are like that because they're told that they can't change their sexual orientation. And so they're hopeless, and that's why, so statistics are very powerful, but once you get them down, people can use them to interpret in all sorts of different ways. So it's important to be very balanced and reasoned in how you look at statistics. I mean, it's very clear there is higher risk on some of these factors, and that's important to know. But higher risk doesn't mean the majority of youth are like that at any given moment.
We would like to provide the same opportunities for a wholesome and happy school experience for all our students, regardless of their sexual orientation, or their race, or their color, or their religion. I just see this as an equality issue. And young children growing up sometime reflect the attitudes of their parents or some of their peers, and they develop those attitudes from lack of information. And I think providing that and providing a common meeting ground for everyone to come together just make a better school experience for everybody. What's done is primarily done locally. It takes a while at the state level to get the funding from the legislature to develop the programs. I don't say it can't be done, but you have to go through a budgetary process, and you have to sell the idea to the people who come up with the legislation and then provide the funding. I just see that it has been done here on a local level, and by local I mean Seacoast, and I think it's a good way to begin. That doesn't mean it's the way you want to end up. Change happens because people want change, demand change, and that people themselves provide the impetus and the momentum for change. If you want to see it happen, you have to work actively to make it happen. And sometimes it doesn't happen overnight. It happens in degrees, but there is a forward movement.
For all the noise on the surface about gay and lesbian issues, I believe that New Hampshire has demonstrated in the past that it is a very caring state. I think that New Hampshire actually is a very welcoming state for gays and lesbians of all ages. It's not really a question, as I said, of lifestyle. It's a question of making sure that we all are treated equally regardless of our sexuality.
You've been listening to Growing Up Queer in New Hampshire, an independent segment for Independent Radio, written and produced by Jennifer Belkis. Among featured, Seacoast Outright, the nonprofit gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and questioning youth support and advocacy group. Support groups for youth through 21 years old are held Fridays 7 to 9 p.m., social nights Tuesdays 7 to 9 p.m., and gender queer group is held the third Wednesday of the month, 7 to 9 p.m. All meetings are held at Community Campus, 100 Campus Drive, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. For upcoming events, go to the website at www.seacoastoutright.com. Thank you to State Senator Martha Fuller Clark, Dr. Paul Cody, and former State Senator Elaine Krasker, as well as the rest of the contributors. I'm Jennifer Belkis. Thank you for listening.
guess there's something wrong with me. Guess I don't fit in. No one wants to touch it. No one knows where to begin. I've got more than one membership, more than one club. And I owe my life to the people that I love. He looks me up and down like he knows what time it is. Like he's got my number, like he thinks it's his. He says, call me Mr. Franco if there's anything I can do. I say, it's Mr. Franco to you. Some days the line I walk turns out to be straight. Other days the line turns to deviate. I've got no criteria for sex or race. I just wanna hear your voice. I just wanna see your face. She looks me up and down like she thinks that I'm mature. Like she's got my number, like it belongs to her. She says, call me Ms. DeFranco if there's anything I can do. I say, I've got spots, I've got stripes too. They're all asking, are you in or are you out? And I've been, oh man, what is this about? I mean, tonight you can't put me up on any shelf, cause I came here alone and I'm gonna leave by myself. I just wanna show you the way that I feel. And when I get tired, you can take the wheel. For me, what's more important is the person that I bring, not just getting to the same restaurant and eating the same thing. Guess there's something wrong with me. Guess I don't fit in. No one wants to touch it. No one knows where to begin. I've got more than one membership, more than one club. And I owe my life to people that I love.
That was In or Out by Ani DeFranco. Next, we have Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week, we present journalist and filmmaker Danny Schechter, who examines the corporate media's coverage of the Downing Street memo, a document that many observers believe confirms the Bush administration's dishonest justification for launching the Iraq war. Barry Bacharach, attorney representing Leonard Peltier, who explains his latest effort to free the Native American who is serving his 30th year in prison on a 1975 murder conviction. And author and journalist Suzanne Gordon, who discusses the shortage of nurses in U.S. hospitals and the crisis in America's healthcare system. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
According to the New Internationalist magazine, a wave of 3 million healthcare workers trained in the Third World have migrated to rich nations to work. For example, there are now more Ethiopian doctors working in Washington, D.C. than reside in the entire country of Ethiopia. The medical brain drain is most acutely felt in sub-Saharan Africa, which is suffering from the combined epidemics of HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. At the Tigoni Community Hospital in rural Kenya, conditions for patients are badly deteriorating. There is little new equipment, and patients sometimes sleep two or three to a bed. Kenyan nurse Nancy Wambui Itocha used to teach student nurses at the hospital. She has over 20 years' experience as a nurse and midwife, as well as knowledge of family planning, community health, and immunization. In 2001, she moved to England and began working in Oxfordshire at a nursing home, making 30 times her salary in Kenya. Itocha says healthcare in Kenya used to be good. It started going downhill in the 1980s due to corruption with the government of former President Daniel Arap Moi. Then, after an economic collapse in the early 90s, the International Monetary Fund took over. Under its structural adjustment policy, Kenya was forced to cut food subsidies and impose user fees for medical care and primary schools. American journalist Todd Smith of the Tampa Tribune was badly beaten and executed as he ventured into the jungles of Peru in 1989 to investigate links between the Maoist Shining Path rebels and cocaine trafficking. At the time, Peru's interior minister blamed the murder on the Shining Path insurgency, saying rebels sold the 28-year-old reporter to drug runners for $30,000, the bounty for anyone suspected of being a U.S. drug enforcement agent. A 1993 secret counterterrorism trial convicted rebel José Manrique to 30 years in jail for the incident, but he was later granted an early release. Now the Associated Press has obtained the secret court transcript of the trial, which points the finger of responsibility at Peru's top cocaine kingpin, Fernando Zevallos, as the mastermind behind Smith's murder. According to intelligence reports in the case file, the rebels who tortured the 28-year-old reporter actually worked for Zevallos and other drug traffickers. The file says Smith was killed because the drug lords feared that the American reporter knew about shipments of 3 tons of cocaine to Colombia. Zevallos has faced charges of contract murder and cocaine trafficking in Peru and Chile. In May, the Inter-American Press Association launched a campaign calling on Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo to reopen the murder investigation. Frustrated by the lack of broadband high-speed internet access, the citizens of the Tri-Cities, a community 45 miles west of Chicago, last year tried to do an end run around Comcast, the local cable operator, and SBC Communications, the telephone company. With the municipal power company installing a fiber optic cable to read meters off-site, residents of the three towns wanted to expand the project to connect homes and businesses to the internet. At the time, area small businesses had to spend as much for a T1 line as they did for rent. The idea of municipal broadband received the endorsement of the local Chamber of Commerce, of which Comcast and SBC were members. According to Mother Jones magazine, high-speed internet service is often more expensive in rural and mid-sized communities. In Iowa, a DSL subscriber must pay $170 a month for basic service, compared to $40 a month in New York City. And half of all rural households can't even get broadband service. SBC and Comcast spent $300,000 to flood the three cities with an avalanche of newspaper ads, push polls, and retirees passing out attack ad leaflets. The industry charged that municipal broadband would increase local taxes and that increased revenue would support access to pornographic material. The ballot measure was defeated by 10 points. Still, the telecom giants got the message. They expanded their fiber network to provide broadband internet services, but the local residents of the Tri-Cities paid for it. Since 2003, Comcast has increased basic cable rates by 30%. Now telecom and cable lobbyists are working to pass federal legislation that would ban community internet and municipal broadband services in all 50 states. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The Downing Street Memo, first published by The Times of London on May the 1st, is a document that records the minutes of a July 2002 meeting of British government officials that indicates that the Bush administration had already made a decision to invade Iraq, justified by intelligence and facts that were being fixed around the policy. Although the document had been released just before Britain's May parliamentary election, generally believed to have reduced the margin of Prime Minister Tony Blair's victory, most major U.S. corporate media outlets have either refused to cover the memo or relegated the story to back pages. But after a surge of grassroots activism pressuring government officials and media companies to pay more attention to the story, the document that many observers believe is a smoking gun in a potentially damaging scandal has begun to command a little more attention. Reporters are beginning to ask more questions of Bush administration officials, while Representative John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, has collected more than 500,000 signatures demanding that President Bush answer questions about the memo. Conyers also conducted a June 16th unofficial hearing on the Downing Street memo that heard testimony from administration critics who maintain the document confirms that President Bush was dishonest in his justification for launching the Iraq War. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with author and filmmaker Danny Schechter of MediaChannel.org. Schechter, whose documentary film, Weapons of Mass Deception, examines how the media failed to challenge the government's dubious rationale for the Iraq War, discusses why U.S. corporate media has thus far failed again to cover a critical news story damaging President Bush and his administration.
The coverage of the government's claims on the war in this country were not covered very well. It's not surprising that a British memo wouldn't be covered very well. We don't cover American memos very well. But even though there has been coverage of the reports, for example, that show there are no WMDs in Iraq, the meaning of it really wasn't explained very clearly. You know, it's not enough just to report something. You really need to explain it. You need to analyze it. You need to put it in a context, make people aware of why it's important to know about it. If you just, you know, we're inundated with so much information every day. It's very hard to keep up with it. There's so many media outlets now. And so when you get this sort of simplistic, you know, more news and less time kind of approach, the consequence is, you know, that people don't learn very much. And when they're surveyed afterwards, you know, about news they've heard, many of them can't remember it. You know, don't know its importance. In terms of the Downing Street memo, this was a group of British policymakers, including the head of intelligence in Britain, came back to Britain in 2002 and said, hey, the Bush people are going to go to war. They need intelligence to be fixed so that we can sell this policy to the British people. A bunch of new memos have come out since. And, of course, this wasn't really discussed very much because the whole strategy, the whole relationship between Blair and Bush has barely been, you know, touched on. We were a very parochial media. We don't discuss or pay a lot of attention to the rest of the world. We'd rather cover Michael Jackson trials than African debt, you know. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why most Americans don't know very much about the world, don't have opinions because they don't have information. And this is why many people feel that our media system is undermining our democracy rather than strengthening it. That's why this issue is so important. And you know what? The American people know that because when they're surveyed on the media, which isn't too often, but when they are, 70% of the American people say they don't like the media for different reasons. Some think it's too left-wing, believe it or not, Scott. Some think it's too right-wing. Some think there's too much sex. Some think there's not enough sex. Whatever the reasons, there's a consensus of complaint. There's a feeling that our media is not doing the job it's supposed to do and a lack of respect for it. And that's an important sign. I mean, just on Saturday, the Boston Globe reported that the support for the war is waning. Now, that doesn't mean that the coverage critical of the war has increased. It's just that people are no longer trusting what they're seeing and reading and hearing. And so they're making up their own mind. And we have a lot more people saying, hey, let's get out of there. This isn't working. Look at all the Americans that are dying. Look at all the people that are being killed. It's not worth it.
USA Today had an interesting article where they kind of explained that they themselves held off on covering the Downing Street memo and its contents because they could not, quote, authenticate the memo, which seemed to me ludicrous given the fact that it had been floating around in Britain and the United States for about a month.
It was reported in Britain, by the way, not by the left-wing press, but by the right-wing press. It was the Times of London, which is owned by, guess who, Rupert Murdoch, that reported it. So, you know, this is preposterous. When you look at what is covered, the number of rumors, the number of stories that are sourced by one source that are never verified, that are constantly in our media, to select this out and say, hey, we can't even report it by attributing it to somebody else. The Times of London is reporting X. You know, it's not up to USA Today to authenticate it. It's to report what leading journalists in other countries are reporting. And this is part of the way in which there's always an excuse about why they can't tell the truth about something. There's always a reason given. But usually when you examine it closely, it doesn't hold up. And, you know, this is one of the problems here.
Danny, I wanted to ask you about some positive signs you might be seeing out there in terms of people finding alternative ways to get information. I know the Internet has facilitated hundreds of thousands of people, if not millions, across this country to break through the information blockade and go directly to BBC and some of the British publications, The Guardian and the like, to get some information that our own media is not providing. Is that something that you can count on in the future to become more accessible?
Battle over the Internet, in fact. You know, the media itself is a battleground. The big interests, you know, often want to keep us from getting access to things, challenge it, and all the rest of it. You know, we have to push ahead with some sort of public interest agenda. And one of the elements of that agenda is to have a media that we can be proud of, that's meaningful, and all the rest.
What's the most effective thing you think people can do in this country to get at the heart of the contents of the Downing Street memo and other such information widely publicized? What can we do?
Well, I mean, first of all, you know, find the websites that are reporting on all of this. There are many of them. And you know, and patronize them and support them. Support independent media. It's not enough to just, you know, assume it's going to be there for you. The big media is funded with millions of dollars of investor money and all kinds of government breaks and deals and tax breaks and the like. Independent media, like your radio show, like MediaChannel.org, we need support, too, in order to stay, you know, alive, to stay in business. And that, you know, to keep serving the public that we can serve. And so this is something that, you know, we all have a responsibility to try to support each other and support progressive media.
That was author and filmmaker Danny Schechter, co-founder of MediaChannel.org and Global Vision. His latest film, Weapons of Mass Deception, examines the media's coverage of the Iraq War. See a trailer of the documentary at www.wmdthefilm.com. One of the most underreported news stories of our time is that of Native American activist Leonard Peltier, who is serving his 30th year of incarceration after being convicted of murdering two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. The killings occurred during a wave of violence that lasted several years and included the deaths of dozens of Native Americans on the reservation. Two other members of the American Indian Movement were acquitted of killing the agents, while charges were dropped against a fourth man. Over the decades, Peltier has become an accomplished painter, author, and defender of human rights around the world from his prison cell in Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary in Kansas. In Europe, he is perhaps the best-known American political prisoner. Despite documented misconduct in his case by federal agents and judges, and despite efforts by an array of attorneys and support committees, Peltier is still in prison. The latest effort to free him came in a hearing on June the 15th in Fargo, North Dakota, site of Peltier's original trial. His attorney for the past 3 years, Barry Buckrock, argued that Peltier had not been charged with murder under the federal statutes regulating crime on Indian reservations, as he should have been. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Buckrock after the hearing. He explains his argument and strategy in this latest attempt to free Leonard Peltier.
The hearing that we had on June 15th involved Leonard's motion to correct an illegal sentence. Boiled to its essentials, the motion challenges the court's lack of jurisdiction to convict and sentence him on the crimes for which he was sentenced. I was shocked, frankly, when I was going over the case with Leonard and realized he was never charged with a reservation crime, because this crime occurred on the reservation, not anywhere else. So boiled to its nuts and bolts, the motion basically challenged that the crimes for which Leonard was convicted and sentenced, the court didn't have jurisdiction because the key element, the requirement that the incident occur on a federal enclave or federal property, was missing.
What are you asking for? A new trial for Leonard, or just his release from prison?
We're asking that since the court never had jurisdiction, that his sentence and convictions be vacated. Whether the United States would then choose to retry him under different statutes is their choice. At a minimum, he should have been charged under the statutes which placed the situs of the crime on the reservation. He never was. And you can't say now, even if he was, he could have been convicted of it. The bottom line is he was charged with what he was charged, and if the court didn't have jurisdiction to charge him with that crime and convict him because it didn't occur in a federal enclave, then there's no jurisdiction. And subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time.
I know from following this case for many years that the original trial judge, Judge Benson, would always come out of retirement to rule against Leonard Whenever his lawyers requested a new hearing or a new trial, any new legal maneuver, Judge Benson, I understand, is no longer among us. What do you know about the new judge that heard your appeal?
I have no idea of his views about Leonard or the incident. We always hope that judges come into these issues impartial and not predisposed, and that's what we're hoping for in this case.
What's the timeline for a decision in this matter?
Typically, you get a decision within any time from right away to 3 months.
Barry Bachrach, what can you say about the efforts of the Leonard Peltier Defense Committee to free Leonard?
The committee is somewhat in flux, so it's hard to... Russ Redner has become the new executive director, and the board has reconstituted. So they're putting into place a very proactive attempt at bringing Leonard's case to the forefront.
You know, this latest legal move is an example of what some people say is the manipulation of our esteemed legal system by smart lawyers in order to free a criminal from prison. What would you say to that?
Well, I'd say, number one, darn right, it's my job to try to correct this injustice, and I'm going to continue to keep pushing issues to correct the injustice. And I don't view it as a lawyer trying to get a criminal out of jail. I view it as someone refusing to bow down and relent to the injustice that has been heaped upon Leonard. That's how I view it. It does get very frustrating when you keep running up against brick walls, for example, when the Tenth Circuit acknowledges undisputed government misconduct. The Eighth Circuit has acknowledged misconduct. The government admits it cannot prove who shot the agents. It's admitted that the U.S. government and certain Canadian officials used fraudulent affidavits to extradite Leonard. It gets very frustrating when you have all that out there and the man nevertheless remains in prison. So people can say whatever they want, but I've committed myself to helping Leonard achieve freedom, and I'm going to keep, along with Leonard and others, continue to use my mind until we get him the freedom he's due.
That was Barry Bachrach, attorney for imprisoned Native American activist Leonard Peltier. For more information, call the Defense Committee at area code 785-842-5774 or visit their website at www.freeleonard.org. Large numbers of experienced nurses across the United States are leaving their profession, causing a critical shortage of the skilled workforce that constitutes the backbone of the healthcare system. Rising costs resulting in hospital staffing cuts and deteriorating working conditions has motivated many RNs to leave the nursing field. The nursing crisis comes at a time when the population of aging and sick patients is on the rise. Award-winning journalist Suzanne Gordon is the author of the book Nursing Against the Odds: How Healthcare Cost-Cutting, Media Stereotypes, and Medical Hubris Undermine Nurses and Patient Care. Through interviews and investigative reporting, Gordon examines the causes of the nursing crisis and, by extension, the crisis in America's healthcare system. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Gordon about her analysis of the problems within the nursing profession, including the lack of respect and recognition many experience on the job. She also looks at solutions such as single-payer universal coverage, addressing the larger crisis of providing quality and inclusive patient care in American medicine.
Well, the problem is that nurses today are taking care of too many patients. They're working too long hours and they're not being paid enough, and they're not being treated well enough by physician colleagues. And the media, it really produces a lot of stereotypes of nurses or incorrect images of nurses. And so as a result, a lot of nurses are feeling quite demoralized because they can't give the care that they have been educated to give and know they can give. A lot of nurses are also aging because, the average age of the nurse is about 47 years old. And, of course, it's normal for nurses to be aging, but it isn't normal that the average age is that old, because what that means is that there aren't enough younger people in the pipeline coming in to replace them. So this is not only a problem for nurses, but it's a really, really serious problem for people in our country who will need nursing care as they get older and sicker. And if we don't change something really quickly, we will have a shortfall of about 500,000 nurses, if not more, by 2020, just in time for the baby boomers to be, you know, in their whatever 80s or so forth, where they will really need a tremendous amount of nursing care.
Suzanne, what's the effectiveness of nursing and healthcare unions in this country to try and improve the conditions for workers such as nurses in the healthcare system, and certainly by extension for the patients, and improving their care?
You know, you can't win anything all by yourself usually. People really need to get together to make progress, particularly when you're dealing with a powerful institutional employer. And nursing unions in this country have been very effective in getting better wages and working conditions for nurses. And because people have no constitutionally protected speech in the American workplace without collective bargaining rights, many nurses who are in non-union settings have been afraid to speak out about patient care issues because they were afraid of being fired. And nurses in unionized settings have had more protections to raise critical issues. They've won things like whistleblower protection, safe needle use in hospitals, better wages, more say in patient care. And one study actually showed that a study that appeared in the Journal of Nursing Administration, I believe it was, showed that cardiac patients in hospitals where there were unions had better mortality rates than in non-union hospitals, and that may be because nurses can speak out more with less fear of reprisal.
America is one of the only industrialized nations in the entire world that does not have a universal health care system.
One.
I wanted you to comment upon, in all your journalistic endeavors of looking into the crisis in the U.S. healthcare system, how important is that we have a national dialogue and debate, and hopefully some resolution that brings us towards universal healthcare and a single payer healthcare insurance system?
We are now spending in this country close to $2 trillion on healthcare. That's almost $6,000 a person. We waste about a half of those dollars on advertising, marketing, and profit, on the highest prescription drug costs in the industrialized world, on unnecessary clinical care and fraud and abuse. That's a tremendous amount of money to be flushing down a black hole that doesn't produce care. And I think that a lot of that money is why we have the misuse and misallocation of that money is why we have a nursing crisis. And we need to capture that money so that we can give obviously better care to more people, and more money to nurses and other clinicians who are providing that care, and other healthcare workers, and better wages and so forth. I mean, if you do the math, you know, you just see that the kind of money that we're wasting is the kind of money that we should be using for caregivers and for care.
Are you optimistic that the insurance companies one day will, their power will diminish to the point where we can really have an effective debate? Because it seems the insurance companies, the healthcare insurance companies, are one of the huge obstacles standing in the way of getting where every other country is.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, hospital administrators are often so knee-jerkly anti-government that they don't understand that having some sort of national health system will really solve their problems and make their job easier. I think it's up to Americans to connect the dots, to figure out, you know, you don't want 45 million people uninsured. You don't want to cut Medicaid in the states. You want high-quality care when you're sick. You don't want to worry about having to call an 800, mother, may I have this treatment, have this extra day in the hospital. Then you should be for some sort of national health system. I mean, there's, you know, a whole bunch of models out there that we could choose from France, Germany, Scandinavia, Canada, Australia. I mean, and I think Americans should really look into this, and they should look at what works in these systems and what doesn't. And I think nurses should really be on the bandwagon for national health care, because those dollars are their job and their satisfaction. And it's those dollars that could be used to make nursing a satisfying long-term career.
That was journalist Suzanne Gordon, author of the book Nursing Against the Odds, How Healthcare Cost-Cutting, Media Stereotypes, and Medical Hubris Undermine Nurses in Patient Care. Visit Gordon's website at www.suzannegordon.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and Real Audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Indu Anand.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Diamond, Brian Gregg, Tom Jackson, Stanley Longstaff, Adam Meyerowitz, Dino Pappas, Joanne Paradise, Damon Thomas, and Jeff White. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. You can also live stream our show on Saturdays from 2 to 4 if you are not in range of the station by going to www.wirenh.com. Remember that WSCA is new and growing and hoping for your membership and your participation. Go to www.wscafm.org to join and learn more. Tune in next Saturday from 2 to 4 for our next Making Waves program. Given that it will be 2 days before July 4th, Independence Day, for the United States, we will be looking at some American traditions, such as the American flag, with an interview with Steve Fowle, founder of Portsmouth's own Flag Police. We leave you with this quote by Winona LaDuke: "We don't want a bigger piece of the pie, we want a different pie."